Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kadenek. Joining me is John Purcell and Ken Doan. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I promised you that I'd tell you my anecdote. We're here for A Life Coloured In, your long-awaited memoir, and I want to tell a story that when I was a kid, we had a questionnaire, I guess, to understand our country, probably 7 or 8. And I remember saying to Mum, okay, what's the best of this? What's the best of that? And it was this bizarre quiz that they give kids. What's the best musician? Jimmy Barnes, easy. You know, who's the best Prime Minister, whoever's in power at the moment, and there's no opinion. And it was, who's the best artist? And I asked Mum and she said, well, Ken Doan, easily. It was the only one that she got straight away. And it always stuck with me because when I got to school the next day, and everyone had to do the same answers, there was one answer that everyone gave, and it was Ken Doan.
Wow.
Because you were so in society, it was the easy answer. You know, it was one. You know, that was the one that couldn't be challenged. So I want to ask before we do anything. I mean, you are such a huge part of Australian culture. I mean, now looking back at it respectively through the book, what was the experience like?
Well, first of all, I have to, of course, give thanks to your mother, a woman of great taste, style,
obviously,
and understanding, and your, in fact, entire class of students. Look, you don't set out when you are a painter to do any of those things. You simply set out to make paintings as good as you can do them. I guess the difference in the time that my work was first seen, because I was 40 when I had my first exhibition, 40, and yet I'd left school at 14 and a half to go to art school. I'd had some experience at business and marketing and mass communication. So the first things that I did sought a wide audience, because there's no point in waiting till the last half hour before you drop off the twig and people say, oh, he's very good. Well, too late.
Yeah.
So essentially, and look, the book business is a perfect example, isn't it? You write the book once and you repeat it. So the first things that I did is the people saw of mine would have been some very disciplined drawings of shells and things like that, easy to like, hard not to like a shell. And then I suppose the thing that really got people's interest would have been those early drawings of Sydney Harbour, which I then put on to a T-shirt, but only made 12. In fact, they had numbers on them. I had no idea that it might go to the size that it was. And in fact, in that original design, we're still selling it. So it's a bit of a surprise to me, I suppose, when people tell me about the effect that it might have had on their work and their understanding of Australia. I can only be very pleased about it. And it's the love that I have of Australia. It's quite transparent. I mean, most artists, you could tell the person. And if you wake up and if you live in Australia, it's not actually Baghdad. So, I mean, it's always, I think, with the respect of the country and what it's taught me and what I've been able to do in it.
Because I've heard you talk about the Australian light in your work that has a special light that draws you as well.
Well, I'm not the first artist to be conscious of that. But yeah, there is a certain clearness and a certain clarity. Somebody was once bold enough, kind enough, or even stupid enough to say that I'd taken the beige out of Australia. I'm not sure whether that's true, but I think in the early 80s, when people first saw my work, I was using colour in a way that people may not have seen before. And because we then had a number of licensing arrangements, so it was on bed linen, people slept under it and people wore it, because I certainly wanted to show that art shouldn't just be found in art galleries, that whatever you do, you should do it as well as you possibly could. Whether it was a duvet cover or a scarf or some swimsuits, you didn't dismiss it. Did it as well as you could.
You mentioned colour, and when I think Ken Doan, I think colour. Big, bold colour. And you're also mentioning the beige. So Tom Roberts and those famous Australian artists at the turn of the dawn of the 20th century, around that period, you've got a particular view of Australia. They do some colourful ones, but you have this sort of dry. And then when you look at your art, and when your art relates closer to the experience that that I have of especially in Sydney, we've got such brightly coloured trees and birds, and the harbour's right there, and the boats on the harbour. Everything seems to be so vibrant. I often looked at those paintings in the National and then in the State Gallery and just went, what were they looking at?
It's interesting, isn't it, that whole kind of outback myth. Well, not so much a myth, but all of us, we're all living on the edge of Australia. We're all clinging to the coastline, essentially. And yet the myth of the outback and the drover and the harshness of that country life, which came to us through the kind of Tom Roberts pictures or even the Fred William pictures or the Sidney Nolan pictures, continued to show that kind of romanticised feeling of the Australian outback. And maybe my paintings were about the edge of Australia. Were about, as you say, about the harbour and about the beach. Of course, the colours have always been there. People often say, oh, they're your colours. Well, they're not. I mean, they're everybody's colours, whether you live in... You can have a garden in Bourke where you've got brightly coloured flowers there. No one owns the colour. But the 80s were quite an optimistic time for Australia. And maybe the timing of my work kind of coincided with that. But there were lots of other. There was the cricket, there was the Come On Aussie, Come On. There was television continuing, there was the America's Cup. There were those things that told us we're really a very beautiful country, a very sophisticated city. We can hold our head up anywhere and we're happy to be here.
That period between the America's Cup and the Bicentennial seemed to be the most colourful period. In my memory, it seems to be such a colourful period.
Well, it was, I think, and a lot of great music happening, a lot of very positive Australian things happening. Even when I went to London in 1965, I went to Japan. It was the first time I ever left Australia because I always thought Australia and Japan would have a very close relationship. And then the second trip, I went to Mexico, I went to America, I went to New York, I was hired in New York, I got to London. I didn't go there with any kind of chip on my shoulder about coming from Australia, thinking, gosh, will I be good enough? Mass communication was strong enough then that you kind of knew where you fitted. Even though when I was a boy, the Woman's Weekly was in sepia, so you didn't see any colour magazines, even though my mother had a subscription to Saturday Evening Post. We lived in McLean in those days, a little town on the north coast on the Clunch River. Now, I can still remember the smell of that magazine, the smell of the reproduction of that magazine, and suddenly you saw things in colour, you saw mass market things. Then there was the big jump, and then suddenly there's television, and suddenly the magazines are in colour, and there's a lot of them, and we're voracious magazine readers, and I think Australia kind of came of age in a sense in that time.
I find it very interesting that that you became, the Kendo we know is from 40 onwards. Mm. That gestation period for an artist, that's pretty long.
It's very late, isn't it? And maybe it's one of the reasons why I don't take any of this peripheral stuff, as pleasant as it is to be sitting here talking to you about this book. It's not overwhelming, you know? Like a lot of young artists, the first... Oh, and there's another use of the word, which is a very difficult word. What I guess I mean is that a lot of people who become famous, in inverted commas, when they're young, it's very hard for them to handle that. It gets for me, what does it matter? I was 40.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'd had lots of hills and valleys up to that point in time, so... You don't take it that seriously. It's not that you don't love it, and especially, you know, you like people who like your work. It's very automatic. People come up and say nice things, and you think, well, thank you very much. But the work itself, you just keep doing it. You just keep going at it. But go back two or three sentences. I talked about young artists. It's a very misused word, the word artist. There's nothing I can personally do about it other than occasionally say, look, I think it's better to describe me as a painter, basically. Mm. When you come out of art school and you say, I am now an artist, I think you probably should go away and paint 500 pictures and then come back and decide whether you'll be an artist. Even Guy Warren, good painter, 95 years of age, still considers himself a mark maker. So in a time when everything can be art, Turner Prize, turning a light bulb on and off, piece of art, maybe not, however, won the Turner Prize, so Yabu sucks to them, and for me to sending it up. But there are all kinds of things that can be art, but I think I'm just a painter, really.
So is it left to us, to like the viewer, to say that's
absolutely
art?
That's that's the most important thing of all. The painting is half the conversation. Art's half the conversation. It's what you bring to it. Now, for instance, I remember talking, or when we I was with a group of people, and they were talking about those early Australian painters of the green and the yellow and the blue of Australia, those kind of early street paintings about the art. Well, they're about Sydney Harbour, really. The most important job in Australia, this is diverging a little bit, new flag. We have to have a new flag.
Yeah.
I mean, if we can, you know, have our own booktopia, why can't we have a new flag?
Yeah. Well, I want to mention that because Ken Doan and Men at Work, and during the 80s, we had Hoag's, going to put a shrimp on the barbie. You were kind of the ambassador, like one of the ambassadors that went out to the whole of the globe with this new story of Australia, this very positive view of Australia.
But see, people tell me all that now, and it's very, why didn't you tell me that then? I didn't know that was happening. I didn't know we were doing that. I read a quote this morning in the paper by George Harrison. He said, if I knew we were going to be the Beatles, we'd have tried harder. But you don't think of that at that. You don't think of that at that time, you know? You just do it.
And I think that's what makes this book so fascinating, because you said that there are peaks and valleys, and there are points where an entire class will say the greatest painter in Australia is Ken Doan, unequivocally. I mean, and so... very good kids. So it is, I think that's what makes this book so fascinating, because, you know, a life unexamined is obviously not a life worth living, and it's seeing you have your own take and on things and your own unique eye. It is. It's incredibly fascinating. I think it's... Yeah, it's perfect timing.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I was flattered to be asked to write the book, and when I started to do it, I sat down and I did nothing for probably 3 or 4 months. And once I started to write, I almost couldn't stop. I wrote a lot more work. I wrote, I think, 140,000 words. It's down to 80,000. But I enjoyed doing it, and yet I've had a lot of help. I mean, I'm a very bad speller.
So is F. Scott Fitzgerald, it's fine.
Yeah, no, and I don't have a computer or anything like that. So fortunately, my daughter sat beside me and corrected the spelling and the quite few politically incorrect things within the book that a man of my age and generation has to be very wary of in this day and age. But it hasn't been sanitised too much. There's still a few things in there that might surprise people.
We've had quite a few... Australians, famous Australians and Australians who haven't been writers in their life, who do sit down and start to tell their own story. And it becomes a kind of, I wouldn't say therapy, but there's a process where they actually examine their life and it puts it into some sort of perspective. We're so busy in our lives that we often don't look back. And to be able to be asked to do a memoir, to be told to sit down and think about what you've done, has that changed how you...
Oh, yeah, look, I was very flattered to ask, and it's been a fantastic thing for me to do, and I would encourage people to write things about their life. As you well know, I mean, both my parents are dead. I can't ask them anything. Mm. And yet there are a lot of questions I'd like to have asked, be able to ask my father or my mother, and even in writing this book, we found out a great deal about my family that I didn't know. Especially, without giving away too much, that my grandparents weren't even married, you know.
Scandalous.
And yet, had 4 children and a long and happy life.
So you're entering the book market in a very strange place where I reckon, I want to say 6 out of 10 last year, John, were colouring books.
Oh yeah.
So this is a strange world as a man who is so well known for his use of colour. You're entering an industry now that has never been so obsessed with colour. I mean, yeah. Are you across the adult colouring books? Do you know what's going on or the craze?
We have some understanding of it. We've had some thought about it. It'll be interesting to see how long that particular thing lasts. I think it's a lot to do with television.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot to do with the computer. It's a lot to do with people making a mark on something rather than simply looking at a screen and absorbing something. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, with your kids, I would be encouraging kids to still make marks on things with crayons. And I think that's one of the things about it. Make the mark on something, and also to lose yourself within it. Yeah, look, we're thinking about it.
Yeah. Did you find painting a cathartic experience? Did you ever struggle with
oh, yeah, look. On the back of my door in the main studio, there was a small sign that I wrote quite a long time ago, and just says, paintings for me. Now that's a much bigger sign, because I've written over it two or three times and made it bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah. Do I understand that that I have to do it just for me? And as you get older, you get better at editing your work. There are less things that you show. At the start, you tend to show too many things, but that's just the nature of it. But it's a struggle. Of course I enjoy it. Of course, the very first thing I do in the morning, before I go down for a swim, I go into the studio to look at the work. A lot of artists do that. I heard an artist the other day describing that. She says, she goes in the studio to see if the fairies have been there through the night. Because, you know, and a lot of times they haven't been there, the buggers.
Yeah.
And so you look at something and you think, no, load of crap, have to paint over it. And in my studio, there are the paintings in the foreground that I'm working on, that I know what to do. There's the paintings halfway down the room that I've stopped working on them because I just can't take them any further at this point in time. And then in the back of the studio, there's this whole lot of little paintings with bloody faces turned to the wall. Poor little buggers in the painting hospital who are on their last legs. Now, occasionally you'll hear a little cough. And you can go over and you can pick up one of those paintings and you can look at it and you can think, I know how to finish that now. I know how to do it. Even though it might be 10 years old, you know how to do it. You can fix it up. Others, they're buggered. Throw them away. Crap.
Mm. Well, if it didn't take a lifetime to become the standard of painter that you are, with the talent that you were given, Andrew and I will be off right now setting up our studio. That sounds like a good morning to me.
That's good. It's interesting. I remember Nick Cave talking about who you assume is going to be the most fluid artist and just like inspiration from the air, and he gets up and puts a suit on every day and goes to an office near his home and sits there, and he says his office is like a psychiatrist's office, but he has to be there, he has to be disciplined like that. It must be tricky when you're trying to be so creative and new, so exuberant with use of colours and imagery, and still be kind of disciplined enough to be able to go through that process.
The hardest time for me was, in a sense, when I made the transition from being the creative director of a big advertising agency where you are solving problems that have been set and you are working with groups and people who are continually giving the feedback as to whether you're good, bad or indifferent, and it's a very definable thing. So at the age of probably 35, I decided I didn't want to do that anymore. And so then I would go down to the studio that I had then, which is an old derelict building in Chinaman's Beach. It's since been knocked down, and on a winter's morning, on a Monday morning, I'd go down there absolutely on my own, hopefully with my dog, and work. So, and you do have to be disciplined. That's where I think a lot of painters go off the rail. They'll think, well, I'll just go to the room and have a couple of drinks, or I'll have a few joints, and then I'll, be able to paint. I don't think so. I think you've got to be very straight, and I think it's hard work. But I can only speak for myself. That's the discipline I have. I quite like to work. I did very little yesterday, very, very little work yesterday, up till about 5:45 in the evening. But from 5:45 till 7:00, I did some quite good things.
Put the dinner
in
the
rest of the day, well, I didn't have to make the dinner, even do the washing up or anything like that. I mean, I was once miraculously named as Father of the Year. I still have no idea what that is because I don't even... maybe putting out the garbage or cleaning up your wardrobe once every 6 months. I don't know. Anyway... it's a great privilege to be a painter, I'd say that. It's a great privilege to be a writer, and you do it because that's what you do.
And now you're both, Ken, painter and writer.
Now both, right, yeah, look, my mother, who was a good writer, had never had anything published, she'd be thrilled at this, and... yeah, look, I think some people will hopefully find things in this book that they didn't imagine about me. And who knows what they'll take out of it.
All right, it's a fascinating book. It's as I said, it's a long awaited. It's been a long time where you've been at the top of the tree, and it's great to get a look in and a deeply personal look. So, Ken, thanks so much for speaking.
It's a great pleasure.
And remember, you can get Ken Doane's A Life Coloured In at booktopia.com.au right now. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.